quick disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities or to make or consider any investment or course of action. For more information, go to bestevershow.com.
It's one thing if you're doing rehabs, value add plays with $3,000 a door versus 15 or 20. I think that you got to crawl before you can walk and walk before you can run. So that's the kind of stuff I'm looking for. Is, are they a bit out to lunch on what their capabilities are? What are the chances they get over their skis on this deal?
Welcome to the Best Ever Show, the world's longest running daily commercial real estate podcast. Our hosts interview commercial real estate experts every day to get you the best advice ever with none of the fluffy stuff.
Best ever listeners, welcome to the Best Real Estate Investing Advice Ever Show. I'm Slocum Reed, and today we are joined by Lance Peterson for another episode of our due diligence mini series. We are focused on the process of vetting your deals after you have them under contract and all of the things that go into determining whether or not a project, a property, a business plan are viable. We have Lance with us. He's the co-founder and CEO of Passive Advantage, which builds online software tools that help limited partners analyze real estate syndications. He has worked with a major private equity firm in the past, but currently has just 20 of his own LP positions in multifamily, Class B industrial, and in real estate debt funds. Our topic for today is limited partner due diligence 101. How can limited partners be vetting the opportunities that general partners bring to them to make sure that their interests and their returns and their potential upside are protected? Lance, can you tell us a little bit more about your background, and then we'll dive in?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Slocum. Appreciate it. I think a bit about my background. At heart, I'm an entrepreneur. I started my first company. It was an IT services business when I was 21. I sold it 7 years later, and I got into real estate in 2008 in the private lending business and really the private fund space. As you sort of alluded to, I was a principal of a real estate private equity firm. We started allocating capital as LPs and then later as sort of more co-GP type relationships into syndications or funds. And we had $0 in that strategy in 2011, and we grew it to over $300 million in equity under management. We also had an accidental business that was a real estate fund administration company. We found out quickly that running a fund-to-funds type strategy, really reliant on the underlying sponsors to produce the information we needed. And we learned that that wasn't necessarily many of their strength. So we ended up providing that as a service, doing all the back office accounting and administration. And so I headed that up and kind of founded that company. And we ended up growing that to over $3 billion in assets under administration. And during that time, I worked a lot with, it was probably over 200 real estate sponsors, helping them architect and launch discretionary pooled investment funds. And I still do that at any given time. I've got two or three clients that I'm helping put together a discretionary pooled fund. And out of all that, I guess I kind of had people want to write their memoirs or book. I ended up creating a video online training course called the Empire Builder Formula that basically teaches people all the things I've been teaching people over the years and helping them with on how to architect a fund and launch a fund and developing a capital raise strategy and plan. So keep pretty busy, but I'm the co-founder and CEO of Passive Advantage. So we're now building out some software tools to help LPs just kind of remove some of the friction on their side of the fence, so to speak, when it comes to conducting due diligence on syndications primarily.
Nice. Yeah. So let's talk about that, Lance. You have a breadth of experience here. Where is it that you see limited partners most often get misled by the offerings or offering memoranda of general partners in this space?
I'm not sure if it's being misled, but I think that, and being a syndicator, and I know as we syndicated quite a few deals ourselves, it's just when you're putting together an OM, trying to make it presentable to LPs, a lot of it's you've got your financial model and then you're trying to shove it all into what amounts to a PDF presentation. So I think it just becomes a bit overwhelming. Every one you get is in different order and has different information. And I think that it's challenging to make sure you've checked all the boxes as an LP. Like, have I looked at all the information? It's not necessarily that syndicators are omitting information intentionally, but let's face it, they're putting their best foot forward. So I think that's the big thing. I'm just a big believer in, this is what I teach LPs. it's okay to ask for the actual financial model that the sponsor put together that came up with much of what amounts to the OM, because then you have the real information. You've got the data that you can look at. You can see how their assumptions worked. And so I think that's the big thing, is just getting their minds wrapped around what assumptions were made. How do they arrive at these conclusions? Why did they choose this exit cap rate as an example? What were the rent growth assumptions and why? And just those sorts of things, which a lot of times just OMs don't necessarily answer those questions directly per se. I mean, some do, some don't. But I think for me, it's just more of having a method to your madness when you're underwriting these deals, and make sure that you're checking all the boxes is the big thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. And misled was the wrong word. I think I should have said something like misunderstood. But yeah, totally. So let's dig into that. As a limited partner, I imagine you receive opportunities from a lot of GPs. When you open that OM or you get into the webinar to be presented the opportunity, what are your template questions that you're planning to make sure you get answers to?
Well, for me, the first thing that I look at are the fees and the waterfall, just to see, are they in line with what I think is market acquisition fee? Is there a disposition fee? What's their asset management fee? Are they vertically integrated? If so, what's the property management fee that they're charging? I just want to figure out, how is the sponsor being compensated? Really what I'm looking for is, do I feel like the way that it's structured, are we aligned? And I think it was the same thing I did when helping all these guys architect their funds, the same thing. I want you to get paid for the value that you, as the sponsor, you need to be compensated for the value that you're bringing. My philosophy with it is, put the money where the work is. So when you're adding value, then you should be compensated. And obviously, if you're able to execute the business plan, then you should earn a big chunk of that upside. But that's the first thing that I go after, is just trying to figure out, is there good alignment here on its face? That's step 1A. 1B is, do I think that the sponsor's team has what it takes to execute the business plan that's being put forth? Have they done this before? Do they have people in each critical position to execute that strategy? Especially a really deep value add strategy, then I'd expect to see someone's name pop up that has lots of construction experience and who's going to run that project. And if it's a core plus play, then that just wouldn't be as important. I wouldn't expect that they'd have someone with that on the asset management team that would have that pedigree. But that's what I'm looking for. Does the team match the business plan, and vice versa?
Thinking about our listeners who are newer to this space, Lance, and don't have the experience that you do to know necessarily what the answers to those questions need to be. What are the roles that need to be filled out in the team? What are some questions that LPs can make sure they get answers to with regards to the general partnership's structure, experience, who it's comprised of, to make sure that they know that they're putting themselves into a position where the business plan they're buying into, literally as well as figuratively, can be successfully executed upon?
Yeah, I simplify. There's four things that I'm looking for. One is, who's in charge of acquisitions? Who's the one that's digging up opportunities, and who wakes up every day and is trying to find new deals? And who's the person who's negotiating those deals in the asset acquisition side? So that's one. And then two, I've alluded to, once the deal's closed, who's responsible for executing that business plan? And I just always use that parlance. Who's waking up in the morning and that's all they care about? The first order of business is, because when you think about a value add strategy, especially, there's a plan, right? We're buying it because there's a problem with it, and we're going to do this to it to add value to get out the other end. So you want to be looking in for signals that says, how are they adding value? If they're saying that they're going to buy it and they're not rehabbing the units or whatever the case may be, but it's all operational, then I want to see there's somebody on the team, even if it's not necessarily a VP level person, but who's the person that's responsible for increasing revenues and decreasing expenses? Who's filling that role? Who's going to make sure that that happens? And then the third thing, who's in charge of investor relations or fundraising? I'm an LP. Who's going to make sure that I get information, or when I do have questions, that's going to be there to respond to it and make sure that all that kind of stuff is being handled and that this group can actually raise capital at velocity and handle that function? And the fourth function, I think, is just back office in general. Who's responsible for producing financial statements? I alluded to it earlier, that seems to always be the missing piece, where they just don't have enough competency in that area. But as an LP, it's super important, because the financials are what it's all about. I want to see those results. I have no say in what goes on day to day, but ultimately the numbers will tell me the story. So just making sure that there's somebody that's competent that can prepare that kind of information, because they could be really great at finding deals, great at executing the strategy. But if I'm never getting updates and I don't really know what the score is, so to speak, that's going to be a problem. And I think as operators or sponsors who are listening, I mean, just understanding that when you're in no position, you have no control over what goes on, your mind can quickly get away from you. You can start thinking the worst. I didn't hear anything. Whereas the sponsor's thinking, man, I'm crushing it for you. I don't have time to go and tell you how it's going because we're just killing it. But then the perception could be completely mismatched. So those are the questions that I think you just want to figure out. Who are these team members? Who's filling those four critical roles is a big piece of it. My opinion is that sometimes we put too much emphasis on track record or experience. A lot of guys are like, we got over 120 years of experience. Okay, maybe you do. But we found as kind of professional LPs is that some of the best deals we ever did were with emerging sponsors, guys who maybe used to work at a CBRE or something like that, and they struck out on their own. So they don't have much principal experience, but they're just hustlers and they can get after it. So track record matters, obviously, because you can look at the past results and see somewhat indicative of the future, but of course, not entirely.
Lance, I've heard some people say that you always want to get into Fund One, because Fund One for a newer syndicator, not necessarily brand new to real estate, but a newer syndicator is the one where they feel the most compelled to outperform their projections because they need to create a track record for themselves. I've heard a few people whose opinion and perspective I really trust and respect here say that. Do you feel similarly?
We did. That was really our entire thesis when we were investing in that manner, was that we weren't going after the guys who had super long track records or was super well established, because what happens is they earn the right to take more of a promote and charge more fees. We did just that. We looked for people who were super hungry and who had something to prove and loved what they did. They had passion, they had conviction about their strategy, and they checked all the other boxes. And I think the thesis proved itself. Because you can lose money with someone who's got a lot of experience just as easy. You can lose someone who doesn't have as much of a track record. And I think as we record this, that's sort of playing out right in front of us. So I'm a huge believer in that.
We'll get back to the show. But first, some sponsors I'm confident you'll find value in learning more about. If you're an investor like me, you're probably looking for one platform to manage the banking and finance needs of your entire portfolio. The good news is there is one. It's called Baselane. And it's the number one banking platform built for independent real estate investors that reduces busy work so you can focus on growing your business. With Baselane, you can earn up to a 4.19% annual percentage yield and 5% cash back on debit card spending with no monthly fees. With a simplified view of your cash flow and expenses, you can retire those tedious spreadsheets. You can also manage unlimited virtual accounts and cards, and even open separate accounts for each property or unit. Join more than 40,000 real estate investors who trust Baselane for their banking, property management, and bookkeeping. Head over to baselane.com/Joe and sign up today for a chance to win a $500 Amazon gift card. That's baselane.com/Joe.
So the vetting that you're putting syndication opportunities through, it feels like it falls into two primary categories. Again, keeping in mind, I'm an owner operator. I'm vertically integrated. I am the property manager. Everyone who touches the property, literally or figuratively, has been hired by me, reports to me. So keeping in mind the perspective of someone who is not an expert in this field, not in operations of real estate or acquisitions, but also not necessarily a professional LP. Lance, it sounds like the things these LPs need to be focused on when considering an opportunity fall into two categories. One is the general partner's compensation and the alignment of interest in that compensation with the LP and their end of the compensation model. And the other is making sure that the general partnership has the expertise and experience, may not be the best way to put it, but the bandwidth necessary to execute on their business plan. Is that a fair summary thus far?
Yeah, that's how I look at it.
Well, let's dive into the bandwidth question here. You identified four key points. These may be new to some of our listeners, but you're certainly not the only person who divides a general partnership into these four categories: acquisitions, operations, investor relations, and back office or administrative, or financial reporting and underwriting, depending on who you ask. When it comes to what you're looking for from an acquisitions specialist, what is it that you want to see within a general partnership, Lance?
The ability to generate deal flow, I think, is the first half of it. It's just, do they have a method to their madness, a strategy for going direct to owners, or a strategy for developing deep relationships with brokers? I don't care so much what it is. I just want to know that they could articulate it and that there's a system or a process in place that generates deal flow. It just tells me a lot, because to me, if they're generating a lot of deal flow, then that means that it is far easier for them to be conservative about the deals that they do. They can be picky. We all do this. We're human beings. We can trick ourselves into thinking like, well, I've only got five deals to look at, and you can just somehow fall in love with one of those five deals. I'd rather know that you've done something to where you got 40 of these things. I'm being a bit dramatic here, but it just sounds like you're in the flow. And I also look at it like, how far are you spread out? I always like it when guys are like, I put a fence around this area. The deal won't hit the market in this particular area that I won't know about. I want to hear things like that. And then on the flip side, the other part of what I think are part of asset acquisition then is that due diligence and underwriting. So I want to hear that, once again, they've got checklists. There's ways that they then take the deals that come through and screen them and kick things out that don't meet a certain criteria. So their box is a little smaller. They're very particular about what it has to be. I just want to hear stuff like that, because it's the same thing. Then I know they know what they're hunting for. They know how to figure out whether it meets that criteria or not. And I just want to know that they, just like me as an LP, I want to check all the boxes on my due diligence checklist. I want to know that they have something similar.
That makes a lot of sense. When it comes to the person who wakes up and the first thing they think about is operations or asset management, what is it that you're looking for from them?
I think there's got to be some amount of leadership and management ability, higher levels of organization, more of a planner and a plotter. What I'm looking for is a conductor type person, like someone who's going to keep the trains on schedule. Like I said, mainly when I know there's just more, it's a deeper value add type of situation. Whereas industrial, as an example, would be different. They don't necessarily have to have that, but they've got to be super connected and know they've got tenants they could put in. So it just depends upon the strategy that they're executing. But just to use deep value add multifamily as a good example, I just want to know that they're highly organized, because I know that it's a lot of work and there's a lot of moving parts. I mean, you've got tenants that are vacating and you've got all sorts of things that are taking place. And once again, if you tell me what the business plan is, then I just want to see that there's a person who I think has a skill set, experience, and competency to actually be able to do that.
And with an operations expert, you've referenced the amount to which experience is necessary for success. Specific to operations specialists, are you finding that people who are newer to asset management or newer to operations within their asset class are able to see similar levels of success as people who are more seasoned veterans when it comes to the business plans they've been able to execute on and the assets they've operated within that asset class already?
No, I think that can be the chink in the armor oftentimes. That's why I just think that's why it's so important to bring others alongside you, right, in some capacity, even if it's not you, but if you can point to our general contractor sort of has that in some way to augment it, even if it is just a mentor who's doing something else. I mean, just something to give you a sense that there's a patch here. And oftentimes they might have something that comes from another industry that's translatable, like I said, because I used to have guys like, well, I've renovated and flipped 200 single family homes. I don't have a track record in multifamily. I would encourage them and say, yeah, but you flipped 200 houses. That's a lot of work too. So don't get too hung up on that. I think that's relevant experience. And if you have a gap on your GP team, that's what I mean. That's why I love this business, is that it's a team sport. I think we all know that. So go find someone. Don't be afraid to dilute your position in the GP or whatever. And bring them in for these very reasons, because it only increases your chances of success. And I've done a lot of financial modeling with guys over the years to show them, like, if you did what you thought you could do, Do you even fully appreciate what the numbers would look like? Do that math. It's worth building a strong team. I have a whole module on this in my course. I mean, because I'm just build your rock star team. It's a team game. If you try to do it on your own, I just don't think you'll find anywhere near the level of success that most people are after. It's more about increasing the size of the pie. So, but yeah, I think people have never done it before. It's one thing if you're doing rehabs, value add plays with $3,000 a door versus 15 or 20. I think that you got to crawl before you can walk and walk before you can run. So that's the kind of stuff I'm looking for. Is are they a bit out to lunch on what their capabilities are? What are the chances they get over their skis on this deal?
Yeah. In the interest of time, Lance, with the questions I still want to ask you, same question. What is it that you're looking for from investor relations and also from the back end specialist or financial analyst who's producing statements? What is it that you're looking for from those two?
I think with the investor relations seat, more than anything, you just know that it's occupied. There's someone who doesn't have six other jobs, but that's their job. Once again, I just want to know that someone's going to be waking up and thinking about, hey, we need to communicate with our LPs. I'm a bit more of a snob probably on the back office function. I just want to know that there's somebody that actually does have some demonstrable experience that isn't just, we've outsourced our bookkeeping to the Philippines. No offense, I had a whole team in the Philippines, but I just want to know that once again, there's someone that's going to provide some leadership and oversight to the function and do it right.
That makes sense. With regards to returning to the topic of compensation and alignment of interest, let me start by making some of my own assumptions and sharing some of my own perspective, Lance, and then just getting your response to it. Feel free to disagree with me for the sake of the listeners, but also for the sake of me. I want to hear your take on this. Of the ways that general partners are compensated, you have, as you said earlier, acquisition and disposition fees, and then you have the waterfalls upon sale, and you have the prospect of additional fees being paid to vertically integrated general partners. In examples like mine, general partners who are also the property management company and the general contractor. So when it comes to acquisition and disposition fees, I get where the GP is coming from, that a lot of work has been done before the property is purchased and that they want some sort of compensation for it. But that is compensation received by general partners before limited partners receive any sort of returns from a property. So kind of hard to say that an acquisition fee is necessarily aligned with an LP's interest. A disposition fee, if it is just a fee paid when the property sells, regardless of the amount it sells for, the returns generated for the LPs, again, it's not necessarily going to be aligned with the interests of the LPs because it doesn't rise and fall with the returns of the LPs experience. When it comes to the waterfall structure or the split on profits above a preferred return, then it makes a lot more sense there. There are ways that you can set up a deal to make sure that the general partners are reaping the greatest reward when the limited partners are as well. And then with vertical integration, I think it has a lot to do with whether or not the fees being charged are reflective of the market of the moment, or whether or not there is some sort of, I don't like to use the word discount, but is the general partnership charging below market because the fees are being provided in-house and they are one of the benefactors as an owner of the property? I just threw a lot of stuff out there. You didn't reference preferred return at the beginning, but a preferred return is one way that you can make sure that an LP's interests are maintained within a deal. Everything I just threw at you, in the interest of time, what are your reactions?
I have no problem with an acquisition fee. I think, once again, put the money where the work is, it's earned. It's a ton of work. And I think that if people fully appreciated and understood what guys had to do to find deals worth doing, which is your job to demonstrate to me that it's a deal worth doing and you're worthy of doing it, no problem with it. Don't like disposition fees unless you're going to forego your promote. Property management fees, as long as they're market, market's just fine with me. I want you to do a good job. It's a separate business. You got to make sure that you can hire the right people and all that. Always a preferred return. There's got to be a hurdle. That's how you protect LP's downside risk. And obviously, if you're overseeing a property manager and you're not vertically integrated, I expect you to charge an asset management fee because I want you to be on top of those guys to make sure that they're doing the job. So I always apply my philosophy to it is just, is the money being put where the work is? And is that amount of money commensurate to the work being done? And if yes, then I'm fine with it. I just need you to defend it.
That makes a lot of sense. Quick take to end the episode, Lance. It's the first quarter of 2024. What are you seeing as market standard for preferred returns, fees, and waterfalls right now?
It seems 8% for a long time. I think we're at, depending upon which risk band we're in, core, value add, or opportunistic, it's going to be anywhere from 9 to maybe 11%.
On the pref.
On the pref, yeah. And then on the promote, if you're getting it straight from $50,000, $100,000 investors, and a 30% promote, 70-30 split above the pref, acquisition fees.
On the promote, is that 30% to the LP or the GP?
No, to the GP. 30% promote to the GP, yeah. So 70-30 above a 9 or a 10 or something like that. It just seems like that's sort of where we've shifted. But that's kind of what I would expect to see. And I think that that's fair given where interest rates are at and where we're at in the market, and it makes it tough. It's a tough environment right now as we record this, just given the higher interest rates. And it just looks like it's going to be a bit before we start to see them ratchet down.
Lance, one last question real quick. What's the best way for our listeners to get in touch with you?
Yeah, so you can go to LinkedIn, just type in my name and connect with me there. You can also go to passivevantage.com. We do have much of what we talked about in today's episode. I've got a masterclass, so it's the multifamily due diligence masterclass. Cover a bunch of the stuff that Slocum and I just hit on.
Those links are in the show notes. Lance, thank you. Best ever listeners, thank you as well for tuning in. If you've gained value from this conversation on due diligence for limited partners in commercial real estate syndications, please do subscribe to our show. Leave us a 5-star review and share this episode with a friend you know we can add value to through our conversation today. Thank you, and have a best ever day.
Thanks, Slocum. Appreciate it.
Hi, best ever listeners. Joe Fairless here again. And one last thing before you go, would you like to receive a short weekly email with proven tips from experienced investors, free tools and resources, and a roundup of the week's most relevant news and best ever content? Well, if so, join the community of nearly 15,000 commercial real estate passive and active investors who receive the best ever newsletter. Just go to bestevercre.com/access. And you'll get the very next one. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, thank you for listening and have a best ever day.